Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous.
Uh-huh. Sarah Shaw, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
In 1971, you were 19 years old.
Yep.
And you had, I guess it was your first job.
It was my first job, yes, and I was working as a junior secretary, basically a shorthand typist, in what was called the School Broadcasting Council. And that was a kind of policy-making and advisory body to the BBC on making broadcasts to schools, radio and television. And the office that I was working in was the one where all the incoming correspondence, which in those days would have been by letter or by phone, we dealt with all of that. So just general inquiries and specific inquiries about programmes.
And one of the programmes that ended up being quite controversial and very well known was a programme on sexual education.
Yeah. Now, the BBC had been putting out programmes for secondary schools about sexual education for several years, and that was relatively uncontroversial. But just the year before that I went to work at the BBC in about 1970, they brought out what they said was a sex education series for primary schools. And that sounded terrible. And I mean, you can imagine the uproar because people thought that, you know, it was going to be very explicit. It was nothing of the sort. It was, I think there were three television programmes and one what they called Radiovision, which was radio programmes with a film strip that accompanied it. And it was basically about sort of bunny rabbits and eggs, you know, and how mummy and daddy get together to make a baby. And that was about it. But there was the most amazing kind of furore and letters coming in and stuff from the press and retired teachers and weird letters in Green Biro and the whole thing. So the office that I worked in was the one that was dealing with all of that. And, you know, we were getting letters every day on the subject.
And it struck me, okay, so we're talking about your book, which essentially you wrote in 1971.
Sure, yes.
because it's the secret diary of a BBC secretary.
Sure.
And you kept a almost daily.
Yeah. Diary. It was daily, yes. Yeah. Well, I was living in a girls' hostel near Victoria. I didn't have a huge amount of money. I was able to go out, you know, a few times with friends and things like that, but I wasn't living a particularly exciting life. And I guess I thought that year, you know, what shall I do in the evenings? Oh, no, I'll keep a diary. That should be fun. And just by chance, that was the one year that I kept a daily diary. And fortunately for me, it was a particularly interesting year. So not only have I got a kind of record of what I did each day, which is interesting in terms of the, you know, what I did in the office and with my friends and going out and doing the shopping and what I bought and how much it cost and that kind of stuff. But I also got engaged in a relationship with a guy, and the diary kind of traces the ebb and flow of that relationship through the year.
Yes. And this was 1971. You're working at the BBC, and we get bits and pieces of the cultural landscape around you. I remember one time you first saw the two Ronnies on television.
Sure, yeah.
And I think your comment was like, oh, they should do well. They stick at it, they ought to do well.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Well, one of the odd things about when you write a diary, of course, is that you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You write down what happens today, and that's that. If you're writing a novel, you generally have an idea of where that novel's going to go, and you have an idea of where it's going to end. So there's a kind of coherence. One of the interesting things about the diary is that, you know, you're kind of like, I've made up my mind, I'm going to do this, and then the next day I do something totally different, because that's what you do in life. You know, you change your mind, don't you? It's a kind of a unique record, in a sense, being a daily diary of what was going on. And I mean, I came from quite a sheltered middle class background. I'd been to an all girls school, I'd been to a girls secretarial college. This was my first job, my first kind of outing into the real world. And I guess that what comes over in the diary is this conflict for me between how I'd been brought up, which was very 1950s British, and the fact that the world has changed, or was changing quite rapidly, particularly in London culturally, the sort of like the end of the 60s, my reaction to that. And of course, The Female Eunuch was published that year and was a huge success. And that begins to filter in, and I'm beginning to think about, hey, hang on a minute, this feminism stuff, you know, which I wasn't really very comfortable with. But, you know, given the relationship I was involved in and so on, I began to start thinking about that as the year progresses.
Radio Gorgeous, Gorgeous Lives.
I also want to talk about, before we get into the relationship, mm-hmm. and how it seems to me you evolved and grew a lot in that year, is that elsewhere in your life, your mother had died 7 years before.
Sure.
Your brother had died before mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
And yet, what's palpable in the book is a certain innocence, but also a profound naivety. By the end of the book, you're much more reflective. But there's no sort of, I don't know, you're not mourning, you're not, and yet you can see your father, we can see reading it, your father has remarried. He is not in the best frame of mind. He is difficult. Your relationship with him is fraught. Your poor stepmother has a terrible relationship with him. One thing that's nice is, you know, she's not the evil stepmother. You seem to get along very well with her.
Well, the unfortunate thing was that after my mother died, my father and I were kind of left together, and he had always been a rather kind of introverted and aloof person. He was a journalist, but he spent a lot of time reading and writing on his own. He didn't like to be interrupted. He liked to be left by himself. And I had quite a difficult time for a couple of years. I was, you know, misbehaving at school and all that kind of stuff. So he obviously thought that we needed to sort this out, and he wanted to hire a housekeeper. But he thought if he hired a housekeeper, then people would talk about him with this woman. So he thought, well, the best thing to do is get married. So he married a lovely lady, my stepmother, Vera, essentially to perform the duties of a housekeeper. He didn't really consider that it was a marriage to him. So I think sort of mentally or emotionally, he considered himself to be still married to my mother. So it was a really, really horrible situation at home, to be honest, because my poor stepmother, who had married him, you know, thinking that this was going to be a proper full marriage, realised fairly quickly that she was not being treated as a wife. She was being treated as a general sort of housekeeper. I was, you know, I accepted the fact that my mother had died, sadly, and that, but, you know, here was this nice lady who was looking after us, cooking meals and all the rest of it. And she and I did get on pretty well. And I just didn't like the way that he was treating her at all. I thought that he needed to accept that life had changed, that he'd made a decision and life had moved on, and, you know, he should be enjoying his life with his new wife. That seemed logical to me. I'm not quite sure I articulated it like that, but in those days, but that's roughly how I felt. Part of, you know, by the time I was 19, that was one of the reasons why I'd moved out. So during the week, I was living in this hostel in Victoria and just went back at the weekends to see them, to sort of help out with shopping and doing that kind of thing and to keep in touch with them.
And during the week, when you're in London working at Portland Place, there are lots of things we consider old-fashioned and anachronistic now. One, there's, you know, you're doing shorthand and on manual typewriters.
Sure.
And there are also the manually operated sort of birdcage
lifts. Yes. Well, yeah, but the whole business of working in an office was so different in those days. Like, you did shorthand, then when you typed it all back, you had multiple carbon copies. If you wanted to organise a meeting, you did a memo to 10 people, you know, and if you had to type some sort of document that was going to be copied widely, you had to do it onto a stencil and take it down somewhere where they ran it off on a Gestetner machine. I mean, everything took that bit longer. On the other hand, a lot more stuff was done by phone, I guess, rather than by email. And certainly the secretaries I worked with, we were a pretty smart bunch, and we would, you know, go to lunch and say, right, I'm just typing a memo to your boss about something or other, and they would say, right, okay, and they'd sort out the answer. So we kind of, got half the job done already, so that when the memo finally turned up, the boss sort of said, oh, I think you'll need to do something. Well, actually, it's done already, you know. So it was, very different kind of environment. We've got no internet, no mobile phones, all that kind of stuff, no email. But it kind of worked in its own way, didn't it?
It did. Although, you know, the things that, as you say, you at that time remained quite naive of, you know, office politics, sexual politics. You know, I mean, it was all, except for one woman that you guys worked for, it was all men.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, there was there were two or three other women there who were all single. I mean, that's what happened. You married the BBC in those days. Mm-hmm. So there's, a bunch of... there was a senior secretary who was probably in her late 50s, I would think, something like that. But it was... The BBC in those days was quite civil service type, and it was very hierarchical, graded sort of things, and there was a certain possibility to move up a few grades, but you weren't ever going to get into the top jobs, no. That was all men.
RadioGorgeous.com.
And one of the jobs that was taken by... I would say more working class men was the lift operators.
Sure, yes.
And shall we introduce Frank?
Let's
introduce Frank.
Frank.
Mr. Francis Brown.
Mr. Francis Brown. Frank was a lovely guy. He was very funny, very generous. He was quite popular, very good humoured. And he and I kind of formed this relationship. I think Frank was married. And his wife was quite badly disabled. And I think I had arrived, you know, sort of from this very sheltered upbringing. I was a bit lonely. I think he was a bit lonely. I think we were both looking for a bit of comfort and affection. And this relationship is, it's kind of odd in a sense. It shouldn't have worked. It was very improbable. And it certainly shouldn't have happened in the sense of the BBC, because lift men were supposed not to, you know, engage in that sort of activity at all. But somehow something clicked and we got together. And the story of that relationship is played out through the year.
Floor by floor.
Floor by floor, yeah. You have to admire his ingenuity. He wasn't great at forward thinking, was our Frank, but he was quite ingenious. And incredibly funny, I think.
He had sort of, you know, your classic gift of the gab, charming Irishman.
Yes, yeah, so. Quirkiness.
Yeah.
And a great sense of fun. And I think his attitude was very much to live for the day and not to take life too seriously. And he was a thoughtful kind of person as well. And you can see, one of the things I think was... when I was editing this diary, was that I had the memories that it brought back, and I could remember, I could see what I'd written down. And I went through and I edited it, and that was all fine, that was great. And I suddenly started looking at it from his point of view. And if you start joining up the dots on his side, because it's only as I reported it, of course, all of a sudden there's another little story that emerges there of how does a man who is, and he was, you know, considerably older than me, how does a man like that deal with a situation where he's got this young girl who's very keen on him, whom he fancies? How is he going to behave? And I think that's a really interesting thing that just never occurred to me at the time, because at 19 you're very focused on yourself, aren't you, and your own world and where you're going. So I think one of the things that fascinates me about the book, in a way, is that you can look at it and you can start sort of seeing how other people are operating and you know, how you join up the dots on their side.
It's what was interesting to me is because, as you say, it was a very improbable relationship. So in one sense, you weren't caught because who'd have thunk, you know, a 19-year-old girl, nice middle-class girl as well, would be... dating, in a sense, what you eventually found out was a 62-year-old. Wow, he was older than we thought.
Yeah, I didn't know that to begin with, which I think
is
quite interesting.
Over time.
Yeah,
and that he's Irish, working class. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so in that sense, those were the outside drivers that people would think it was improbable. Mm. The fact that there was something going on was obvious.
Mm.
And yet that's what I'm saying, the naivety or the sort of sexual politics that went on in offices at the time was like, sure, pinch a couple of butts, you know? I mean, which now, I mean, one of the things you're naive to is sexual assault when it happens to a friend of yours. I mean, it's like that not even being in the consciousness.
Yeah. I mean, that was, I mean, I feel bad about that, really.
Mm.
I'm not sure what happened to that girl. This was when I went on a holiday with a friend. And on the final evening of this holiday, she was very upset because she said that this man had assaulted her. Now, I don't know what her definition of assault was, and I never did find out the details of what had happened. And it's possible that it was actually quite a mild thing that she interpreted badly, or it is, of course, possible that something really awful did happen to her. But I didn't know what an assault was. I didn't know what it meant.
Yeah.
I'd had such limited experience that I just probably thought he'd thumped her or something. I don't know. I didn't really kind of engage with it at all. I feel very bad about that now, I must say.
Yeah.
Nowadays, there would immediately be a recognition and a way of following that up and dealing with it. But there wasn't really a way of doing it.
Yeah.
Certainly in those days, and, you know, I was there's sort of various odd moments, either experienced it myself or knew of other people where somebody had a bit of a grope or something like that. But you, I wouldn't say you learned to live with it, you didn't like it, you avoided that person, you know, shoved them off or whatever it was. But you didn't complain in a sense that you didn't go and report it to somebody because nobody was going to take you seriously, you know.
And that's why where it starts to creep in Germaine Greer's book.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of books that you read at the time, there was a lot of music you listened to, both classical, pop. But that book in particular does, because you start talking to your friends about it, and your friends, your friend Jill, who's married to this, sounds like an awful relationship.
the Hungarian artist,
Kaz, quite abusive, you know, in our modern.
I think they had some good moments, but I only heard about the bad stuff. Yes.
Yeah,
it was a fairly volatile relationship, I think. Yeah,
But yeah, that starts it. Because it's so part, you can see between your parents, your stepmother, it's so part of the fabric around you. It's so part of the wallpaper. It's not as we would look at it now.
No.
And it's one of those things that does look starkly different.
Yes. I think it was, it's a different environment where you're, it's almost like the things that you can't define because there's no language to define them. It's just a given. I was thinking about this the other day. I mean, say, for example, supposing in 50 years' time men could invent a way in which they could produce babies without needing women. How that would affect marriage and normal relationships that we take for a norm, and people, you know, in 100 years time might look back and say, my God, did they have to go through all that marriage business in order to have children, you know? You know, and they would just not understand how we think today. And it's almost a little bit like that. I mean, that's a rather more extreme example, but you know, how we thought in those days. It wasn't that we were all desperate to go off and be nuclear scientists or something like that and felt repressed. It was just not in the language that the majority of us were not, you know, accepted that we were, this is how it was going to be. We were going to be secretaries and nurses and teachers and people like that, and we're going to largely be playing second fiddle, and the men were going to run the show. And when Germaine Greer's book came out, that was quite explosive because it was building on other people's work, obviously, but it was sort of saying, no, actually, you don't have to do that. You can do it for yourself. And that was quite a shock to me because I thought I was there to be nice to other people. You know, that's how I'd been brought up.
And wait for your nice young man.
My weekday fix. Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
And I have to say, Frank, when you take his character compared to the quote-unquote nice young men you did meet, Alistair, and say Dick Hughes, he was far more engaging.
Oh, yeah.
Far more entertaining.
Mm.
And a lot nicer.
Yeah, he was a bloody good kisser as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there was sort of a weird mix of like kind of fatherly, yes. and he sort of took you to hand for being so pliable with him.
Yes,
like,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like you should let people, you should let me do this.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And he was, well, he was a very straightforward sort of person. Mm. He wasn't going to complicate life, and I just think he thought this was his lucky day. He'd got this girl, thought he was wonderful. And she would listen to him. And mm-hmm. I always think we shouldn't underestimate that attraction of somebody who would just sit and listen to you. I was fascinated by him. I loved to hear him talk about, you know, his Irish childhood. I mean, I'd never met an Irishman before. This was just brilliant.
And he'd worked all over London. And
he'd done all sorts of things, yeah. Yes. But I'd just never met anybody like him before. And I was fascinated by him. As you can tell from the diary, because I sit and write down all the sort of things that he'd been telling me. And that must have been lovely for him, to have somebody who was so fascinated by him.
Especially in a job where you are largely invisible.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, that was one of the interesting things.
For both of you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Frank thought he was as good as anybody else. Mm. And if you were prepared to treat him and on a level, he would do anything for you. He would be, you know, he was a very kind man. What he didn't like was when people didn't speak to him. You know, he was friendly. They would come into the lift. He would talk to them. And sometimes people just blanked him because, you know, he was the lift man. We don't need to talk to you. And I just think that's so rude. You know, this is just a nice guy trying to pass the time of day with you. How can you do this?
Yeah, you've basically stepped into his office.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
That's where he conducted his business.
Well, he used to say, come into the parlour, which is a very Irish thing to say. Yeah. You know, that was his territory, you know.
It also turned into the boudoir.
And the boudoir, yeah.
When he brought it down to the basement.
Yeah, well, that was so funny because, you know, being a birdcage lift, you could see in. So he craftily worked out, eventually, it took him a while to do it, but he worked out where he could stick the lift where, you know, nobody could see in. So,
What has surprised you the most in refinding this diary of yours?
Partly the understanding that Frank treated me with a great deal of consideration, I think, mm-hmm. And that the guy loved me, and I don't think I understood that at the time. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest thing. But then also, on another level, just the difference in the way that, as I was saying, the way that offices worked and the way that we worked and the kind of the hours we spent typing the same. We had the thing about the exploding ginger beer where we had to sit and type letters to every school in the country. It couldn't be reprographically distributed because that would be rude. We had to sit and type a letter to every single school, and I think that probably about 8 secretaries worked on that for about 3 weeks.
Wow.
So you had to do a personal letter to each school. I mean, nobody would do that nowadays.
Nope. You'd have to find it online yourself.
Oh, that's right.
Or explode.
Yes, or explode.
You should have read the fine print.
Yeah, you should have worked it out yourself.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are, I think, the two differences, yeah.
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 Were you surprised sort of by the flippancy of your youth?
No. I've always been like that.
Nothing changed there.
No.
Well,
no.
I was impressed that, you know, because Frank very quite persistently wanted you out of the elevator and into bed.
Yeah.
Understandably.
Mm-hmm.
But I was quite impressed with your resistance to that.
Sure.
That you sort of knew that this was one thing and not another.
I think that's quite interesting because there's this kind of suggestion that because he was so much older than me, he must have some kind of slightly sinister intent. You know, this is the guy who's trying to chat this girl up to get her to go to bed with him. And I don't think it was that at all. And I think what happens to me during the course of the year is that I kind of work out, you know, what do I want out of this? Hang on a minute. Because, you know, it all comes as a bit of a shock to begin with. And I kind of think, okay, this is not a long-term relationship for me. I'm not going to get married and, you know, live happily ever after with this man. However much I care about him, because he is so much older than me, there's not going to be a, you know, 40-year marriage in there. Therefore, what am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? And so my tension for the rest of the year is how do I deal with my feelings and what decisions I make, and how I can get to control the relationship so I can get out of it what I want. And I think it's actually quite possible to read this book rather than saying this is a man who is manipulating this girl is also manipulating this man to make sure she gets what she wants.
This girl is sexually educating herself.
Yeah.
In a time and place where literally you turn to like 17th century poetry.
Oh, yes. You know, in desperation.
Yeah, exactly. There was nothing on the internet to tell you, you know, yes. Passion and pressing. You're like, no, I really need information.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
So your shortcut to that.
The Earl of Rochester was about as far the best I could get. Yeah.
Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous lives.
Yes, I mean, there wasn't as much information around. Even medical dictionaries, I can remember looking them up. I mean, they were just useless. And it was quite hard. I suppose there probably were places where I could have found this stuff. I was at once smart enough to work it out. And I was too shy to talk to my friends about it, you know. So I just sort of did the best I could. And Frank was the, you know, a helpful teacher. He was quite happy to explain things to me as well.
none to please. No trouble at all.
No trouble at all. Yeah, even if it was in a sort of slightly gibberish film, but there we are. Yeah.
Well, is it sort of a love letter to BBC and
to those days
and those times
and to the strange mix of people that were like the SBC and my friends. And It's just before, really, I found my feet and made other friendships and met other people and went on and had a sort of, you know, happy and successful life. It's just at that point.
That cusp.
Yeah, where I was finding out about the world. Yeah, it was a good year.
Yeah, no, it seemed like, well, and also things like that, I'm really glad you say that, because it did have adventure and it did have strife and struggle, but it didn't have damage.
No. That's very interesting you say that, because one of the things, you just reminded me, when I found the diary, I went and had lunch with a friend of mine in Cambridge, which is where I used to work, and I said to her, look, I've just found this diary, and I said, I'm thinking, what am I going to do about this, you know? And I was still feeling a little bit uncomfortable about that relationship, because immediately afterwards, you know, as I got older, looking back, I thought, God, have I done all this stuff with this man? God, this is all, my children must never know. And all this kind of thing. And I was talking to this friend of mine, and I said, it's all a bit, you know, do I really want everybody to know about this? And she said, well, nobody got hurt, did they? Not badly. And I said, no. And she said, nobody got damaged. And I said, yeah, that's true. And she said, so what are you worrying about? I thought, oh, you're right.
Yeah.
And that's it, you know.
Yeah. That it was, that it was an actual time of play and discovery for you.
Yeah, and there was a lot of fun in it. Mm. And it had its sadder moments, but on the whole, I look back on it as having been a very life-enhancing relationship, which before I hadn't thought about it at all. I just thought, crikey, you know.
Because again, you thought about it from your perspective.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And also, it's quite true, despite the high body count, you wouldn't think. You know, dad dies, his wife dies, you know, people are dropping like flies.
Yes.
Like, oh, yeah. Life goes on.
But that's just an extraordinary coincidence that the thing that brought Frank and me together, partly, was because his wife was disabled, and I had this, you know, very, very difficult father. And so, as you say, part of Frank's role in my life was to be the acceptable father, to be the yes. kindly father, and the sort of the counsellor, you know, the kind of somebody who was going to advise me on how to do things, as much as being this rather weird boyfriend. And yet the two of them died within 6 months of each other. My father died in April 73. Frank's wife died in September 73. Mm. And suddenly those restraints went, but by that time I think things were beginning to unravel between me and Frank anyway. Mm. But it was just such an odd coincidence that they went at the same time,
bracketed. Yeah. Mm. But I think that part, either maternal or paternal, depending on who the older partner is, May December romances, it is part paternal and maternal, because you've been that, and that's part of your experience.
Sure. And also, you can't expect a young guy to have the kind of knowledge and experience that you need, or that I needed anyway, because I hadn't had this sort of relationship with my father. The kind of thing that fathers are supposed to do hadn't happened. Yeah. So I found it somewhere else, you know.
Sarah Shaw, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
RadioGorgeous.com.